Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the unexplained and unsettling radical change in U.S. foreign policy the Trump administration has brought about, where close allies are punished and insulted while adversaries like Russia are praised and dictators, despots, murderers and kleptocrats in Saudi Arabia, the Philippines and Turkey are rewarded. Thomas Berger, professor of international relations at Boston University who specializes in German politics and political culture, joins us to discuss the puzzling nature of Trump's about-face in U.S. relations, with close allies like Germany, Australia, and South Korea gratuitously insulted while thugs and dictators are praised. We'll examine the embarrassing optics of a preening president pushing aside the leader of a small European country, and the disgust across Europe at Trump's boorish behavior during the NATO summit and the G7 meeting, as well as the extent to which the September elections in Germany will be all about running against Trump. Then we will speak with Joan Williams, distinguished professor of law at the University of California Hastings College of Law, who joins us to discuss her new book, White Working Class: Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. We'll look into why populist movements around the world are gaining traction among the white working class and how much of the elite's analysis of the white working class is misguided and rooted in class cluelessness. Then finally, Diane Standett, the executive vice president of the Center for Responsible Lending, joins us to examine the stealth move on the part of House Republicans who slipped in a free pass to payday lenders and car title loan sharks in the Financial Choice Act pushed by the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, Texas Republican Jeb Hensarling. He happens to be the largest individual recipient of money from the payday lenders and title loan bottom feeders that charge up to 400% interest on predatory loans and hold onto car titles, charging exorbitant interest rates which, if you fall behind in payments, means you lose your transportation to work. And joining us now is Thomas Berger, who's a professor of international relations at Boston University, who specializes in German and Japanese politics, international relations, and comparative government and political culture. He's the author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II, and Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Berger.
Pleasure to be talking with you.
Well, thank you, Thomas. And I'm trying to get an understanding here of the extraordinary, almost incomprehensible foreign policy of the Trump administration, where Donald Trump goes out of his way to insult America's longest and most enduring allies, whether it's hanging up on the Australian Prime Minister, insulting Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, both in the White House and during last week's NATO summit in Brussels, and then later in Sicily at the G7 meeting. And at the same time, of course, he just absolutely worships Putin. Putin can do no wrong, even though he's trying to undermine the West and Western Europe. And he praises this murderous thug in the Philippines. He praises this egomaniacal, anti-democratic, authoritarian leader in Turkey who's jailing just about everybody he can get his hands on. He's nice to him. He insults the South Koreans, our important allies, whose capital city, Seoul, could be obliterated at any moment by the North Koreans. This is just incomprehensible. Have you figured it out? What's going on here? What is the subtext? Why would an American president be trying to destroy America's, the foundation of American national security?
Well, it's obviously a pretty provocative way in which you're phrasing it, but there certainly is, it's a very difficult to try to figure out what is the method to Trump's madness. I mean, any individual case, you can make a case for reaching out, for example, to the Saudis, isolating Iran, looking for ways to work more closely, reset the relationship. Virtually every American presidency since 2000 has been trying to restart relations with Russia. But put all together, it's very hard to make sense out of what's going on. And it is having a very corrosive and damaging effect in our relations with some of our oldest traditional allies, notably in Europe.
Well, Chancellor Merkel made it pretty clear that She said the other day, the times when we can completely rely on others are, to an extent, over. And, of course, it looks as though Trump has responded to Angela Merkel's comments just on Tuesday, May the 30th, at 3:40 a.m., I might add. Donald Trump tweets out, "We have a massive in caps trade deficit with Germany, plus they pay far less in caps than they should on NATO and military. Very bad for US. This will change." So without getting into the details of how inaccurate that statement is, obviously he's doubling down. Do you think it's in response to Angela Merkel's comments?
Well, undoubtedly it is. I mean, Trump has a pattern of doubling down whenever somebody defies him. And this is just fits further into that pattern. Now, the quick question, of course, that one has to ask is, what are the concrete consequences of this particular fight? We've had many fights in the alliance before. You may remember from 2003, we had the old Europe versus the new Europe and the crisis over Iraq. Going back in the 1990s, the United States was not eager to get involved in the former Yugoslavia. We left it to the Europeans, and they didn't do a terribly good job dealing with Milosevic and Karadzic. And if you go even further back, I mean, you know, during the Cold War, it was we constantly had seesawing relations with our European allies, including the Germans. So to some extent, this is a continuation of older patterns. And each time that we've had these crises in the past, we have been able to reestablish relations. It's been both in our interests and in the interests of our allies, including our European allies, to not let relations deteriorate too far. Will this time be different, I guess, is the sort of question that one has to ask. Well, in some ways, the basic structural, I mean, beyond the really, and I think here, you know, you really do have to look at the personalities involved, but beyond the sort of these personalities, are there sort of structural conditions, are there sort of fundamental things, the, you know, tectonic plates of international politics, have they shifted in such a way that we're really going to have a rupture this time? It's too early to tell, of course, but on this score, I think that the Europeans, including the Germans, are not ready to give up on us that quickly. Merkel, now one of the things one has to remember is when Merkel made her comment about saying Europe must now take its fate into its own hands. We cannot rely on others. We have to understand also that she is, first of all, and I think on a personal level, there is some reaction to the sort of rather rude behavior that Trump engaged in, pushing aside, for example, the Prime Minister of Montenegro in the photo shoot at the Brussels meeting. So I think there's a personal reaction. But beyond that, we also have to understand that right now there is an election campaign getting underway in Germany. In the fall of this year, we're going to have federal elections in Germany. And this issue, this question of how to shape Germany's and Europe's relationship to the United States under Donald Trump, is moving now very quickly to the center stage. And the different political parties, there's a kind of universal consensus, as far as I can see, looking at the German press, watching the German media, there's a kind of universal consensus that Trump's behavior goes beyond the pale, and that if somebody has to stand up to him. This is, you know, he's treating NATO like some kind of protection racket. Somebody called the German newspaper the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, which is the sort of standard bearer of conservatism in Germany, and usually a traditionally pro-Atlantic, pro-American newspaper, described Donald Trump as Don Trump, you know, sort of like an American godfather coming down and saying, pay up your dues or else. So, you know, there's that kind of political dynamic which is taking hold right now in Germany, and Merkel is not going to let her opponents on the left outflank her on this issue. But at the same time, if you listen carefully to both the sort of things which people in the German foreign ministry and defense ministry, including and also people inside of Merkel's own government, within her government office, what they call the Kanzleramt, so the German equivalent of the White House, they are at the same time sort of pointing out that in the future, while we have a problem with this particular presidency, we will need to work with the United States. And the reason for that is because, quite simply, what the Europeans still cannot do without us, especially in the field of security policy. While one could say conceivably, you know, the European countries could come together and create, for example, their own military force, including an atomic deterrent, a nuclear weapon deterrent. In practice, this would be enormously difficult. It would be difficult politically, it would be expensive, and it would create enormous tensions internationally. So for this reason, the Europeans, including and the Germans, are not yet ready to give up on this relationship, this alliance. But in the shorter run, in the next few months, next few years, we're going to have a very difficult transatlantic relationship.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Berger, who's a professor of international relations at Boston University, who specializes in German and Japanese politics, international relations, and comparative government and political culture. He's the author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II, and Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan. And you mentioned the opposition. Of course, this is a coalition government where Angela Merkel is in coalition with the center-left Social Democrats who are running against her, in effect. And their leader, Martin Schulz, told reporters that Trump was, quote, the destroyer of all Western values. And then the foreign minister, who also comes from the same party, the Social Democrats, Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel, also was even more critical, quoting him, "Anyone who accelerates climate change by weakening environmental protection, who sells more weapons in conflict zones, and who does not want to politically resolve religious conflicts is putting peace in Europe at risk. The short-sighted policy of the American government is against the interests of the European Union." So you can see in those statements that Angela Merkel has to, I mean, in other words, this September election in Germany, they're going to be all running against Trump.
Yes, there's no doubt about it. I mean, there is, just on every kind of central issue, be it trade, be it the environment, be it sort of national security, there are now going to be very sharp differences drawn between the way in which interests in Europe are defined as opposed to the interests of the United States. And it's going to be ugly, quite frankly, Ian. It's not going to be a very happy picture. And it's not only Germany. I mean, these attitudes are widely shared in much of the European continent. Britain is a little bit different. I think on the right end of the political spectrum, we have, you know, the people who support Brexit, we have a somewhat different picture. But in France, in Holland, in Italy, I think that there is a, by and large, among the major political parties, a kind of consensus which the United States is now really rupturing with Europe on a whole broad range of different issues. Now, what will that mean concretely? What can the Europeans do? I don't think they're going to give up NATO. They're not going to, impose economic sanctions on the United States. That's, impossible. But I do think it means that the Europeans will be going their own way in a broad range of issues, beginning with climate change. They're going to push forward the Paris Accord, which is seeking to reduce greenhouse gases. They're going to try to forge ahead on that without the United States. They may look for ways of reaching out to other economies, especially in East Asia, reaching out to China, reaching out to India, reaching out to Japan, Korea, and in effect create alternative free trade or enhanced trade agreements, which won't include the United States. And in general, we're going to see, a kind of isolation of the United States in a number of different diplomatic areas.
Well, we all saw the extraordinary video of Trump in this boorish way, elbowing aside Dusko Markovic, the Prime Minister of Montenegro, which is the country that's just entering the EU. It's like, the country that's about to enter gets elbowed out of the way. But not only does he elbow this guy out of the way, he steps in front and then he puffs his chest up like some sort of peacock. It was embarrassing. It was childish. You know, I believe now that the Brits would never have voted Brexit in the current context. This is before Trump came in. This is when all of that populism was on the boil. But they must be having buyer's remorse. I mean, people in the United States are having buyer's remorse, for God's sake. He's at 37% and plunging. And, it's possible that he and his family are going to end up in jail. So it's so outrageous.
Well, it's going to be, I do not claim to be have any particular expertise in terms of U.S. politics. But, beyond what any other well-educated and informed citizen has. But, it is quite clear that it's going to be difficult, based on the evidence that is available to us so far, to find a crime with which to charge at least Trump and his most immediate circle. We'll see about Jared Kushner. But, even a liberal like Dershowitz points out, what is the statute that under which one could charge them? And, of course, 37%, 39%, and you take a look at the sort of average of different polls of people still support the Trump administration, and that 39% is overwhelmingly in the Republican Party. And so they represent, therefore, 60, 70% of the Republican base. And since the Republicans control the House and the Senate, through which any kind of impeachment process would have to take would have to go, Trump's position in terms of removing Trump from office is very unlikely. And I think quite a few. I've spoken to some of the people who are involved with European and East Asian diplomats, and they're all aware of this, and they are going on the assumption that at least for a couple of years, possibly through this term at least, we're going to have a Trump administration. They're going to have to work with that. And so I think if looking at the German newspapers, looking at the Japanese papers, the assumption is that they're going to have to learn to deal with this situation for now. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, a reality that not only we in the United States, but also people abroad have to come to terms with. Now, that may change. We have new revelations, new developments, but that seems like a very plausible scenario to a lot of people. And means that they're going to have to do their foreign policy, based upon such an expectation.
Well, absolutely. And the president is, to this extent, above the law, except he can be impeached, and that's more of a political than a legal process. But it does seem now that General Flynn has actually made a deal with the FBI. That's why he turned down the deal with the, or his lawyers did turn down the deals with the Senate Intelligence Committee in terms of their subpoenas. So it seems that there is a case being made and that Flynn is squealing on the others. And frankly, the only explanation, at least one of the main explanations, is glaring us in the face for this insane foreign policy of insulting your closest allies, tearing up your alliances, not even wanting to acknowledge Article 5 of the NATO treaty when the Europeans came to the US's rescue after 9/11 and fought beside them in Afghanistan. The only rational explanation, at least that I can come up with, for this behavior on the part of Trump's is that somehow he's got some secret relationship with Putin, who's the main beneficiary of tearing up and destroying America's security arrangements. So that seems to be inescapable. But just let's finish up in the last couple of minutes here with some of the factual stuff here rather than speculate. The trade deficit with the US and Germany is $67.8 billion, and Trump again tweeted about that today. But Germany also in last year bought $80.4 billion of US products. Most of the, he talks about the BMW. For some reason or other, Trump hates BMW. I mean, for God's sake, they've got factories here in the United States. Is Trump prepared to put hundreds of thousands of Americans out of work down in those right-to-work southern states?
Well, I rather doubt it. And I think that, when push comes to shove, there is going to be, there's more bluster than bite involved here. Germans and Europeans are major investors in the American economy. As you pointed out, hundreds of thousands of American jobs are connected to trade with Europe. German and Europeans have large investments in the United States, and really sort of an economic divorce would be simply catastrophic. And I think, beyond Trump, we have to also take a look at the broader White House, and there are are lots of people who have a much closer to a traditional understanding of American foreign policy and American national interests, beginning with General Mattis as the Secretary of State, Steve Mnuchin in Treasury, Rex Tillerson, and all of them, I think, are much more internationalist, much more have instincts which are much more in line with traditional American foreign policy. And I think that sets quite sharp limits on what this White House is able to do. But these atmospherics and these kinds of initiatives that Trump has undertaken are having an effect. And, of course, the key issue, of course, is how will Trump act in the context of a real crisis, for example, in the on the Korean Peninsula, or in the European context, where we have to be especially careful, is the Baltic states. If we have a major military conflict which breaks out in those areas, Trump, as commander-in-chief, has a great deal of latitude to move things in one direction or another. And it's, I think, in those moments that people who think a lot about these issues, that kind of scenario, that people really have a lot of fears and concerns.
Right. This infantile, egotistical, insecure blowhard has the nuclear codes. But just aside from that, just in the last second here, I wanted to get at your sense, because you're both an expert on German politics and Japanese politics. Why is it that Trump has a good relationship with Abe, the Japanese leader? Is it because he has business deals and because he was the first guy to come to Trump Tower and Abe flattered Trump? Is that what it comes down to, if you flatter this insecure ego?
Well, I think that there's two things. I mean, I do think that there is the fact that the Japanese very quickly and successfully managed to reach out to Trump already before he got into the White House, right after his victory in November last year. And Trump, Abe is very skillful. He's good at interpersonal relationships. And so the two men have managed to, you know, playing golf together, talking together, have established a positive relationship. But I think beyond that, there is also the fact that at least on the issue of Russia, and this reinforces some of your suspicions, but on the issue of Russia, Japan and the United States, albeit for different reasons, do have a certain coincidence of interest. The Japanese are less concerned about Crimea, less concerned about the Ukraine than, let's say, the Europeans, and certainly than Angela Merkel is. And they are interested in reaching out to Russia in order to weaken relations between China and and Russia. I mean, the primary concern for Japanese policymakers is how to deal with this gigantic, on and off, occasionally, you know, quite hostile, certainly assertive superpower in their own backyard. And China and Russia have a very close strategic relationship. Lots of military technology is being supplied by Russia to the People's Republic, energy, economic ties. And so the Japanese want to be able to weaken that relationship, if possible, reach out to the Russians as a balance against the People's Republic of China. Also, Abe is very concerned about North Korea, and you know, Trump shares that point of view. So there is a coincidence, a limited coincidence, but a very real coincidence in strategic views between Japan and the United States. And therefore, we haven't seen the same kind of disunity, the same kind of tensions and frictions between Tokyo and Washington that we've seen between Washington and our European allies, especially in Berlin.
Well, Thomas Berger, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Berger, who's a professor of international relations at Boston University, who specializes in German and Japanese politics, international relations and comparative government and political culture. He's the author of War Guilt and World Politics After World War II and Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the author of the new book, White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Joan Williams, Distinguished Professor of Law and Hastings Foundation Chair at the University of California Hastings College of Law, an expert on social class. Her books include What Works for Women at Work, Unbending Gender, Why Family and Work Conflict and What to Do About It. And her latest book just out is White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Williams.
Delighted to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, thank you, Joan. And we, of course, are in a very peculiar political landscape where conservatives, cold warriors, red baiters on the Republican side are now making excuses for Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump's apparent relationship with him. And on the left, you have the people that were normally suspicious of the CIA, hoping somehow that the CIA will provide the smoking gun to impeach Donald Trump. So in that context, your warning in your book about how the left in this country are helping to solidify Donald Trump's popularity with the white working class and are virtually guaranteeing him a second term as president. Since many of our listeners out here in Southern California in drive time in their cars are political leftists, give us your explanation for that warning.
Well, first of all, it's great to be on Pacifica Radio. It's a great institution, and I've followed it and admired it for a long time. I think that, sad to say, that in many ways the left is playing into Trump's hands, and we are in a lot of different ways. One of the things I think we have to really look out for on the left is writing off Trump voters as too racist, sexist, homophobic, even to merit our lofty attention. I think that there's certainly enough racism to go around in the United States. The styles of racism among the elite are very different from the styles of racism among the white working class. But to have privileged white people looking down at less privileged white people and writing off their economic pain on the grounds that those other people, as other white people, are too racist to be heard, there's something really, really wrong with that. And the sociological literature has noted for a long time that one of the things that unfortunately happens is that white people displace the blame for racism onto white people of of different classes. I think that we really have to hear the economic pain of the white working class, and I think it should be easy for us to, on the left, to do that because it's the same pain that's expressed by communities of color. I mean, it hit communities of color some decades earlier before it hit the white working class, and it's affected low-income people for a long time. All of these people just simply want what the cultural elites already have, which is jobs that yield their vision of a solid middle-class life. And if you don't have that kind of job, particularly if your father and grandfather did, which is the situation of many in the white working class, a lot of the issues that the left has at the center of their attention just aren't at the center of your attention. That's what you want. And, you know, as I've been saying to other people, you know, I care deeply about trans bathrooms. I am, I'm very deeply concerned as a mother at the high level of suicide among trans youth. But on the other hand, I have a good job myself, and so do my kids. And if we didn't, that probably would be at the center of my attention.
So, Joan Williams, what happened then to the FDR coalition that the Democrats had for so long, up until relatively recently, and now, arguably, if you voted for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, you'd still end up with Goldman Sachs running the country. And clearly, a lot of what you've written about in your new book is pretty much what happened in many ways at the very contentious discussion that took place in Harvard just after the election, where the Trump campaign people met with the Hillary campaign people. And I recall the Hillary campaign people rather self-righteously saying, well, how could, you know, if you won by reaching out to racists, then, you know, we don't care. We're happy to lose. I mean, it was just so childish and petulant. And, you know, clearly a lot of what you're talking about is all of the mistakes that Hillary Clinton made.
You know, in some ways, the white working class has the insight that the left shares, which is on a range of issues, not all of them, and I don't share this completely, but the left and the white working class do share the vision that there really wasn't that much difference between mainline Republicans and mainline Democrats. And I think that in terms of delivering what many, many in this group want, which is jobs that lead to a solid, if modest, middle-class standard of living for people who have not graduated from college, neither the Democrats nor the Republicans have spent enough time talking about this issue. And, you know, more's the pity, Republicans have talked about it more than Democrats. Now, they've talked about it in ways that I think people on the left find truly off-putting. I mean, their solution is more coal and more supply-side economics. I mean, I think supply-side economics, you know, hey, tried it, didn't work, moving on. But the left has given the right in this country the inestimable gift of being the party that is speaking to the working class of this country about jobs. Why are we doing this? This is insane. The people in Silicon Valley, I think, in my humble opinion, should stop talking about a guaranteed annual income, because this isn't Sweden and that will never happen. And if it happened, it would be a pretty modest income. The Silicon Valley should get its act together and start working with manufacturers to invent the next generation of upskilled working class, blue collar, and working poor jobs, so that we can begin to give people without college educations a solid standard of living.
So one of the people that praised your book, of course, Ali Hochschild at Berkeley, the sociologist, wrote a book about the white working class in Louisiana, Strangers in Their Own Land, and she's very...
great book.
And one of the things that I interviewed her at the time the book came out, and she pointed out that the one person that seems to be able to cross those lines between the sort of self-righteous... left and the alienated right in terms of white working class, it was Bernie Sanders. Is that something that you agree that he, I mean, he actually tried recently to give the Democrats a wake-up call by saying, you know, let's forget about the stuff that you were talking about, gender issues, even though they're important, and identity politics, and let's go out there and work, toil in the political landscape over the issues that everybody have in common, which is bread and butter issues.
Well, you know, I'm as someone who's worked on gender issues for 3-4 decades, I kind of think that that's the kind of zero-sum thinking that is not super helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Bernie Sanders did some things that really allowed him to connect very deeply to some white working class voters. One was to decry corporate cronyism, and I think that that was sorely lacking, and that Hillary Clinton, for all that I deeply admire her, was very poorly placed to do that. I think that somebody like Elizabeth, so I think that that's one of the things that Bernie Sanders did, that the Democratic Party should wake up and smell the coffee. I think that Bernie Sanders also, I mean, in many ways, that what epitomizes this election to me is an Ohio voter saying, Trump voter saying, we voted with our middle finger. I think the white working class did vote with their middle finger. And I think that's one of the reasons they were attracted both to Trump and to Bernie Sanders, is both of those guys had kind of given the middle finger to their parties. And that's why both of them were quite effective at channeling this anger. Elizabeth Warren also has pretty much perfect pitch on this issue. She comes from a blue-collar family, and she knows how to fight this fight. I mean, I think we do have people in the Democratic Party, Sherrod Brown is another one, who could be very effective spokespeople.
Well, I find it extraordinary, though, just in general, that we sort of had, you know, going back to the FDR coalition, we sort of had a social democracy in this country from, say, 1944 to 77, roughly. And I find it extraordinary how alienated, and this is the heart of your new book, White Working Class, how alienated white working Americans or working Americans, middle class Americans, all Americans are in many ways from their government. And is that a function of the fact that we don't have that simple formula where you pay your taxes and get your government services, and if the politicians don't function properly and are not good stewards of your tax money, then you boot them out. In this case, there's just this alienation that on the left and the right, and with conspiracy theories, etc., that basically it's a gift to the plutocrats. If the working people, people who, as you point out, who have the most to gain from the government, don't trust the government, want nothing to do with it, then we're all lost.
Well, I mean, I think that in many ways, the fact that the white working class is so anti-government is an amazing payoff from a 30, 40-year deep investment by conservatives in turning Americans against the government. And I think that the left and the liberals have been incredibly lackadaisical in trying to present the other point of view. For example, one of the things I have proposed is just a very simple YouTube campaign of, like, I got up this morning and my kids drank milk for breakfast. Thank you, Uncle Sam, for keeping us safe. Then we jumped in the car and went on the freeway, and I went to work. Thank you, Uncle Sam, for building the highway. Then I sat down at my desk and used the Internet. Thank you, DARPA, for creating the Internet. I mean, we have, I think that the fact that the ordinary Americans don't know how deeply government has improved their lives, that's working for one of the parties, and it ain't ours. So at some level, I think we've met the enemy, and she is us, and we should just get our act together. So I think partly it's a messaging problem. I think partly also it's a policy design problem, because since it's been so difficult in the U.S. to get anything passed, and certainly social programs passed, the tendency has been to settle for programs targeted to the most vulnerable, targeted to the poor. And the Republicans have pushed Democrats in that direction, and Democrats have followed. I think it's extremely ill-advised, because then you have a whole series of social programs that give benefits to the poor and nothing to those just one notch above. That is actually a recipe for class conflict between the have-nots and the have-a-littles, and that's exactly what we've seen. So if we want to continue to fuel a negative attitude towards government, we should definitely continue with means-tested social programs. If we want to begin to fuel a more positive attitude towards government, we should begin to focus on universal programs. And look at Obamacare as an example. Obama, bless his heart, deeply admire the man, could not stop talking about the 20 million who were newly insured by the Affordable Care Act. He barely mentioned, in comparison, the two universal elements of that program, which were the ability to keep your kids on your insurance until age 26 and the pre-existing condition changes, so that you couldn't kick someone off or refuse to give them health insurance due to a pre-existing condition. He barely mentioned those. But now when we see what's happening, it's proving very difficult to overturn Obamacare because the universal elements of that program are so popular. We should listen to that. That's how we should design social programs in the United States in order to avoid triggering this class conflict and to command almost immediate political untouchability.
Well, Joan Williams, I'm very appreciative that you joined us. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you very much for your interest. Good night.
Good night. And again, I've been speaking with Joan Williams, who's a distinguished professor of law and the Hastings Foundation chair at the University of California Hastings College of Law, an expert on social class. Her books include What Works for Women at Work, Unbending Gender, Why Family and Work Conflict, and What to Do, Conflict and What to Do About It. And her latest book just out is White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the Republicans in Congress are about to give a free pass to the payday lending bottom feeders and the car title lenders.
You've been born with white skin, they explain, and the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame. And the poor white remains on the caboose of the train, but it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in our game.
Night skies finish west. You're running out of gas. Your sympathy will get you left behind. Living on command.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Diane Standert, who is the Executive Vice President of the Center for Responsible Lending, where she directs their state-level policy agenda to advance responsible lending policy and practices, and has authored numerous reports on the payday lending industry. Welcome to Background Briefing, Diane Standert.
Thank you for having me.
And you, among others, have discovered this free pass for payday lenders and car title lenders in the Financial Choice Act, the bill before Congress, and it looks as if they've really tried to slip this in without anybody noticing. It's on page 403 of the 589-page Financial Choice Act, and this is what it states. This is section 733 of the bill. It declares that federal authorities, quote, may not exercise any rulemaking, enforcement, or other authority with respect to payday loans, vehicle title loans, and other similar loans. So what does this mean? Set us up with what the Obama administration has tried to do through the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and what the Republicans are now stripping out.
Sure. I mean, I think it's helpful to remember what payday loans are and the damage that they do is context for what's going on. So just, you know, payday loans on average carry 300% interest rates, leaving people in a harmful cycle of unaffordable debt. And one of the things that is happening to rein in the abusive practices by payday lenders is enforcement action and rulemaking by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has not only taken enforcement actions against payday lenders for unfair and abusive practices of such as overcharging service members or destroying records or illegal debt collection tactics and really revealing the cycle of debt that really drives the payday lender's business model. The other thing that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been doing is working on draft rules that will essentially say that payday lenders should ensure that loans are affordable and that people can pay back these loans without defaulting on other expenses or having to repeatedly reborrow. And so as the Bureau, as the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is moving forward in its work to stop the debt trap, this provision in the Financial Choice Act is really Congress's attempt to block the CFPB. And so it's a huge gift to the payday lenders, but in reality, it's going to leave millions of families across the country struggling with the unaffordable payday debt trap.
So given that Maxine Waters is trying to stop them, there's still the Republicans have a majority. And many people argue now that because of the daily scandals that explode on the front pages of the Washington Post and the New York Times about Trump and his people close to him, including his own son-in-law, being in a deeply mired in this Russian scandal, which won't go away and seems more and more to be really almost reaching the level of treason. But nevertheless, while the White House may be distracted, it looks like the Republicans are pushing ahead. Do you think, I know it's a political question, it may not be what your expertise covers, but do you think that in any way this distracted White House and the constant headlines serve to distract people from noticing what the House Republicans are up to?
Well, I think one thing to note is that actually the White House is also making moves to benefit the payday lenders and block the CFPB. In the recent budget proposed by the Trump administration, they attempt to gut the CFPB's funding, which would then benefit payday lenders and others. So we're seeing these moves in multiple fronts, but both of these efforts to benefit payday lenders and make it easier for them to exploit people, both of these moves are really at odds with the vast majority of the American public, in which poll after poll shows that voters have a highly unfavorable opinion of payday lenders. And as one recent example, in November of last year, 76% of voters in South Dakota went to the polls and voted to reduce the cost of payday lenders and cap the rates at 36%. So that's just further evidence that across the board, you know, 400% interest rate payday loans is just outrageous, and we should be taking steps to rein in those practices rather than making it easier for them to trap people in unaffordable debt that's going to harm them for the long run.
But you would think that 400% interest rates would be called loan sharking, which is what it is. And I thought loan sharking was something the mafia was involved with, and I thought it was against the law. How could it be legal to do this, what they're doing?
Payday lenders are able to charge these excessive rates because the state legislature allows them to do so. So these excessive interest rates are what's authorized in state law. So, in fact, there in California, payday lenders are charged, and it's legal to charge over 400% interest rates on a payday loan. And for loans over $2,500, these loans can still carry triple-digit unlimited interest rates. So the cost of these loans really is a decision for state lawmakers to make steps to rein in, and also Congress has the ability to enact a rate cap as well. And so we do see ways to rein in these abusive costs, and that's exactly what Congress did for the military, as you noted, that Congress passed bipartisan reform, capping the rates of payday loans at 36% for loans made to active duty military, and that's that was at upon recommendation by the U.S. Department of Defense, who found that these loans were so harmful that it was actually undermining military readiness, and so they took steps to rein in these excessive costs. And it's a really common sense, important protection for our members of the military, but it leaves veterans and people all across the country otherwise exposed to these harmful abuses.
Well, as you pointed out, Diane Standen, it's not just the Republican Congress. It's at the state level, these draconian practices have to be reined in. And that, again, leads one to wonder about our state representatives, particularly here in California, where the Democrats control the legislature. Clearly, these bottom-feeding payday lenders to spread their money around politically, and we can get into that. But I just want to touch on what you just mentioned about the executive branch. Obviously, Secretary of Treasury Steve Mnuchin is himself a bottom feeder. I mean, he made a fortune by kicking people out of their homes here in California, and was Donald Trump's campaign manager and has been rewarded and sees himself as a kind of a mini-me to Donald Trump. He has the same kind of trophy wife. He doesn't have his own private jet, doesn't have that kind of money, but obviously would like to. And the American Bankers Association have submitted a report to him calling for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's proposed payday lending rules and regulatory changes to be blocked. So they're on the same page. What's the other? My understanding is I had read somewhere in the financial pages a while back that when you talk about these title loans, which are also another form of this bottom feeding that's going on with payday lenders, title loans are just as exploitative. But basically, these are people that loan against the title on their car, and as they get threatened to lose their wheels so they can't get to work, they keep upping the ante and charging them more. Just walk us through that, because I understanding that is also a bubble on Wall Street, not unlike the housing subprime housing bubble. There's a subprime title car loan situation brewing as well.
Right. So car title loans are essentially payday lenders' cousins in the sense that they carry many of the same dangerous characteristics as payday loans, where they can reach, carry triple-digit interest rates, well over 100% there in California. They take access to a borrower's car title, which gives the lender extreme leverage over the borrower and leads to the same cycle of repeat refinancing, leaving borrowers stuck in a rock and a hard place of paying fees upon fees for this unaffordable loan or risk having their car seized by these car title lenders for their unaffordable loans. And in California, there has been significant growth in this times of harmful lending practices, particularly for loans over $2,500, which don't have any limits on the cost of the loans there. So car title lending is a significant concern and is one that can be addressed at the state level through reining in the cost, and then also car title lenders would, the work that the CFPB is doing to undertake enforcement actions or issue rules that ensure loans are affordable in light of a borrower's expenses, that would apply to car title loans as well. But yet this provision in the Choice Act and the Choice Act as a whole, which is essentially blocking the CFPB from doing its work to rein in predatory lenders, again, the Choice Act would benefit car title lenders but leave hurting all the people who are stuck and would be stuck in these unaffordable car title loans that could result in the loss of thousands of vehicles across the state.
So, Diane Standard, let's look at how we understand how this works at the federal level because of the donations from the lobbyists for payday lenders and car title lenders. You mentioned a lot of it could be fixed at the state level. So obviously there's trickle down corruption there in the sense that these people who are predators and who are really exploiting people in a shameless way that even the mafia would be embarrassed by, they obviously are rewarded by legislators and the public that these legislators are supposed to represent are getting shafted. And little wonder there's so much anger and angst out there and opiate addiction with the kind of pressure that we find people are placed under in these conditions just to treading water, trying to survive and feed their families and be able to hold onto the car to drive to work. The top recipient of the $15 million on campaign contributions from the payday lenders in the 2014 election cycle, the top recipient with $225,000 in donations from the payday lending industry was the National Republican Congressional Committee. The largest individual recipient with $210,500 in payday loans and title loan cash was, guess who? Jeb Hensarling, the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, who is now, of course, behind this attempt by the Congress in the Financial Choice Act, of which Hensoling is the author, to block the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's ability to prevent this kind of exploitation. So this is the writing's on the wall. I mean, do you, in your job, do you ever get frustrated that somehow there's just not enough outrage out there? What explains how these people can get away with, you know, really hurting their fellow American citizens for, you know, and enabling the worst kind of practices and the worst kind of people to get rich?
So one thing we've seen is that across the board, there's across the board consensus in reining in the harms of these payday lending practices. And so we've seen time and time after again in the places where people speak out and reach out to their Congress members and let them know that they know that it's unacceptable for their elected officials to be supporting 400% interest rate payday loans over the interest of people back home, that that's really unacceptable, that we've seen time and time again that this is a real chance for people to make their voices heard and to listen and to really make a difference in curbing these abusive financial practices.
So what would you recommend our audience, since many of them may be as angry as I am at this disgusting practice?
The best thing to do is call your member of Congress, your members of the House of Representatives, and the members of the your members of the U.S. Senate, and tell them to oppose the Wrong Choice Act, to stand up for everyday people, and to tell Congress to stop defending payday lending and oppose the Choice Act.
But it's going to be voted on this week. So what happens if the Republicans, which I think is likely, vote it through? Where does it go, and what can be done to stop it if once it passes?
So the next place it is set for a vote is on the floor of the House of Representatives. It may not be till next week when Congress returns. So this would be a great week to be, as Congress members are home, for them to be hearing from you, through phone calls and emails. If it passes from the House of Representatives, it would go to the U.S. Senate. That would be the next place for people to make their voices heard, is in the Senate. And so letting your Congress members know to stop defending payday lending and to oppose the Choice Act, this is a great week to do that.
And, of course, if it gets out of the House and it gets past the Senate, there's no question that Trump will sign it, right? So it has to be stopped before it gets to Trump's desk.
The sooner it can be stopped, the better. Correct.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Diane Standard.
Great. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Diane Standard, who's an executive vice president of the Center for Responsible Lending, where she directs their state-level policy agenda to advance responsible lending policy and practices, and has authored numerous reports on the payday lending industry. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.